Rachel Jonas, April 15th, 2004.
The first question is I want you to give me a little bit of your family history. Just a general idea of your mother when she came to Syria and your father when he came to Syria.
When they came to Syria.
They came to America.
They were born in Syria.
Yeah.
My father was born in 1896. Mother was born in 1906.
Wait, this is recording now?
Yes.
Okay.
1906. My mother came to America when she was 60 years old, which makes it 1912. My father came here around 1914, 1915.
Okay.
And he came here to escape the draft from the Ottoman Empire, because Syria was under the domination of the Turks. And in 1914, the First World War started, and he was reaching the age of 18, and they wanted him in the army. And that's when his family decided to send him to America. So he came to America. He was the only one from his family to come to America. He had two brothers, and he had four sisters.
All younger?
They all left. They were all mostly, they were all older than him.
Oh.
He was youngest boy anyway in the family. And when he came here, he lived with his cousin, which was Solomon Gerazi.
Okay.
And at that time he was married to a German Jew. Her name was Eliza, and they lived in the Bronx.
Okay.
When the first Syrian Jews came to America, like many of the immigrants, they settled on the east side. They had a synagogue on the east side on Orchard Street. But my father grew up in the Bronx. He started going to work. In the early 1920s, he went into business and he started to make money. And when he was 26 years old, he was introduced to my mother. She was 16 years old, and they decided to get married. When they got married, already the migration was going from the east side to Brooklyn, to Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, and many of the Syrian Jews, especially the ones who were making some kind of money, decided to move to Brooklyn because it was a completely new area. Homes were being built over there, and when they moved to Bensonhurst, it was mostly farm area.
Really?
Yes. There were many, many areas that still had farms, and it was just being developed in those days. And they decided to move to Brooklyn, and he had two girls, two of my sisters, and I was born in 1926, October 1926, and they were all very, very happy because my father finally had a boy. And I was born on a Saturday, and the Milad was on the following Saturday. And it was the end of October, and my father tells me that they had a large crowd that went to the hospital, which is the Maimonides Hospital in Brooklyn.
Okay.
In those days, it was called the Israel Zion Hospital.
Oh, really?
Really. And we had the bris over there. Of course, you know, I can't remember it.
Oh, because your mother was still in the hospital after a week?
Yes. In those days, the mothers, when they gave birth, stayed in the hospital for a whole week.
So the Brit Milah was always in the hospital?
In the hospital, yes. And it didn't make any difference whether girl or boy, they always stayed in the hospital. And not like today where the minute they give birth, they're up and walking around, and the doctors are pushing them, and after 1 or 2 days, they're out of the hospital. In those days, they took their time. I guess they felt in those days that, it would be too hard on a woman who just gave birth to be up and doing strenuous work. today they found out that it's the best thing for the mothers to get up and move out. I grew up in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. And my early years, I don't recall too much of it. I remember when I was about, the earliest that I can remember is when I was about 4 years old. I was taken to the Hebrew, to a Hebrew class that I was in a pushcart. That I still remember that. I remember the man who had a pushcart. You don't know what a pushcart is. They don't use them today.
But in those days, a shopping cart.
It's like a large, there's nothing that I can relate it to today. But if you ever see pictures of the old East Side, there were many pushcarts on the street selling their wares, clothes. That's what it was. And I remember going to Hebrew. I started going to Hebrew at a very early age, at about 4 years old. And when I was about 7, we moved from one area in Bensonhurst and moved to another house on 64th Street off 20th Avenue. And we stayed there for about, I would say, about 10 years. And that's where I was bar mitzvah. I was bar mitzvah in that area. And there wasn't too many things that was really going on in the world. I recall very vividly that in the early 30s, when I was going to school, I was going to a school that was predominantly Italian children. And I, of course, you know, was Jewish, and we had, and most of my friends were Italians in those days, yes. And I recall very clearly when Italy invaded Ethiopia. I think it was in the year maybe 1933. All the Italians in the school were very jubilant, you know. And I said to myself, how can they be jubilant? I mean, here's a big country like Italy attacking a small nation like Ethiopia that probably didn't even have an army. And that was the beginning of the Second World War, really. After that, it was the Spanish Civil War, and then in 1939, the Second World War began in Europe. We didn't get into the war until 1941, but in 1941, I was only 14 years old when the war started, and I recall very clearly how we heard about the attack on Pearl Harbor by the Japanese. Making the remark, I said, how can this small nation decide to attack America? America will demolish it in no time. But they're going quite a few years before they did win the war. My early years was a very happy, I was very happy. I was able to go out and do whatever I wanted. My parents were not strict. Us. We always went out. We went out at night. We stayed out at night with other boys and girls, and those were good years for me. I had a very good time then.
What about religious-wise, like your community?
The community in those days, it wasn't a very large community. There was this one big synagogue that we had on 67th Street, okay, off 20th Avenue, and it's not that big of a synagogue. Maybe there's 250 men's seats in the whole synagogue. And when I became of age, when I became bar mitzvah, I did not pray with my father. I went to another minyan, which was in the which was next door to the synagogue, where they had the Talmud Torah. That's where I went to Talmud Torah. And Saturdays, they had a very large room upstairs where we used to pray. And I recall when I was growing up with my father, he was always interested in Pizmonim, always interested in Bakashot, always interested in music. He loved loved the Ashkenaz Hasanut, because when he grew up in the Bronx, and there were no Sephardic synagogues up there, no Syrian Sephardic synagogues up there. So he had to go to the Ashkenazim synagogue, and that's where he developed a liking to Ashkenaz Hasanut. And not only in the Hasanut, but he also grew up eating all of the Ashkenazic delicacies, which the Syrian Jews were not into, like gefilte fish, or eating cream cheese and lox, or bagels, or we used to have, everybody had Syrian bread, and then, pita bread. We grew up, enjoying all these, this chopped liver. No Syrian has ever eats chopped liver or gefilte fish. They wouldn't know how to make it.
Yeah.
But my mother learned to make it, and we grew up liking all these dishes.
So your father, he was 19 when he came to America?
He was 18.
He was 18. So, that's a very big transition from Syria to America, and then not only just from Syria to America, but from Syrian traditions to Ashkenaz traditions. Did he have a hard time adjusting? Syrian music, Syrian singing, Syrian
My father was,
is so
my
different.
My father was a very open-minded individual. He, when I say he loved Ashkenaz Hasanut, he used to tell me about the great Moshe Oishe, or Yosele Rosenblatt, who he went to see at a concert. He always spoke about his magnificent voice. And in those days, the big opera star was Enrico Caruso. And he loved Enrico Caruso also. He used to love music. Didn't make any difference what kind of music. Of course, he still enjoyed, Arabic music. But for him, it was something new coming from Syria. What did he know about Ashkenaz Hasanut?
Yeah.
What did he know about opera? What did he know about, all these other influences? But he was very open-minded, and he had a very, very good ear. And when he used to hear a song, he was able to remember it. And when we were growing up, he would be singing a lot of these songs. And we learned many of the pizmonim, of the bakashot, and when you're young, very easy for you to learn, and it picked up very, very quickly. And that's how my brother and I, we became very much influenced by this type of Hasanut. As for being a Hasan, growing up, I never even thought of being a Hasan. I never thought that I had the capabilities of being a Hasan. After I was married, and after maybe your mother and Marilyn was born, we had to move from our synagogue to another synagogue, and they didn't want to rehire the Hasan that was in that synagogue.
They didn't like him?
Not that they didn't like him, it's just that they wanted to make a new change.
Yeah.
And they decided to have volunteers every week. About after 3-4 weeks, they came to me and they said, listen, you do next week. I was shocked that they would ask me, because I never thought that I would have the capabilities of being a Hasan. I came home and I told my father, I said, Dad, they want me to say Nishmat next week. He said, why not? Do it. I said, but Dad, I don't know anything. How am I going to get up there? He said, don't worry about it. He said, I'll bring somebody. During the week, he'll go over it with him. And he brought somebody who was very knowledgeable in our type of Hasanut. And he sat with me for about a half hour, an hour. For an hour. And he saw that I was capable of leading the prayers. And he said, don't worry about it. You just get up there and do your thing. And when I got up there and I finished praying that first week, they were all very, very happy. And they said, okay, you are our Hasan from now on. So That's how I got into this profession. I never really went to school for it, or and also, it wasn't my profession. I was working, you know. So I really didn't take it very seriously. It became not as a profession for me, but as a hobby. I enjoyed doing it, and whatever came to my mind, I would do, I would say, and of course, over the years, I started to obtain more and more knowledge of the different makam, which is very important in Hazanut, and I picked up a lot from other Hazanim, and even today, now I'm with Beth Torah over 40, 45 years, I think, and I still love it, I still enjoy doing it, and God give me the strength and the years to continue.
When you first started doing Chazanu, it was basically, the music was basically something that you had learned already, you knew, because you did it every week, right?
Right.
So, but did you have any background, any musical background at all?
No, I knew nothing about music.
Nothing about makam, nothing.
But I knew that I had a fairly good voice, because even when I went to public school, in my, the years between the 7th and 10th grade, I went to the school on 65th Street and 16th Avenue,
yeah,
which was I think I was the only Jew in the whole class. And of course they tested voices, and they saw that I can sing. They put me into the Glee Club, and in those days, the Glee Club, what did they sing? They sang mostly Christmas songs and songs for Easter and songs for Thanksgiving, and I had a soprano voice in those days.
Oh, wow.
I had a very thin soprano voice. And I enjoyed singing from my youth. I loved singing. And, I think I always said if I would put my mind to it, I could have been a singer like Frank Sinatra or Victor Moen or Andy Williams. I mean, but I never had the education. You know, it's got to be taught. You got to be taught music. You got to be taught how to project your voice, and which I never did. So, what else did you want?
What else? Okay. So, since your father lived maybe 10 years in an Ashkenaz community, do you think what he learned, any of his musical background from the Ashkenaz community influenced you?
The only thing that I got from that is that on many of the holidays, like Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, after we came out of the synagogue, we would make Kiddush and have Mazah. And then he would say, okay, come on, let's go. And he would take me to the Ashkenazic synagogues. And we would listen to the Ashkenazic Hazanu.
Wow.
And from that, I started to enjoy Hazanu. And, of course, you know, when I started being the Hazan, most of my time was in the Arabic music and the Pizmonim and the Bekeshur. But I still had the enjoyment. I recall my brother-in-law, which is Claire's sister Molly, and my sister-in-law Molly Kaplow,
yeah.
You remember her? Her husband was Ashkenaz, Harry Kaplow, and he asked me one day, he says, would you like to go listen to Kutzevisky? I says, what kind of a concert? He says, no, it's the Selahot. Selahot, 12 o'clock midnight. This was just before Rosh Hashanah. Type of music came out, I would say, you know, I don't go for this music. But after listening to it, you know, for a while, I became, you know, I started to enjoy rock and roll, metal, whatever, all these different type of music, rap music. I mean, I'm starting now to enjoy rap music, hip hop.
I don't even enjoy it.
No, you know, but the more you hear it, the more you understand it, and you enjoy it. But here, my father, every once in a while, he would he would give me the Ashkenaz melody, you know, and we would sing some of those songs. But we always sang every Friday night after dinner. We sang the whole family. We would sing, my brother and I, and even my sisters, Auntie Sally. He enjoyed singing. So, you know, when you grow up, that's why I say, soon you're going to get married, and your children are going to have children. Always try to introduce them while they're young to different types of music, to symphony. Good for a child to grow up to like music, because if you enjoy music, it can bring the best out for your life. You can have a beautiful life.
I love that. Okay, so now just a few more questions. So you know this, I don't know if it's a decree or what they decided, but at some point the Syrian community decided that they weren't going to allow converts into their community, right?
I think it's better if you don't even put that into your thesis.
Not at all?
No. But if you want me to talk about it, I'll talk about it.
Okay. But tell me why you don't want me to. Should I pause it?
No. No, you can put it on, because this is only for you.
Right. Tell me why you don't want to put it in.
You see, the Torah tells you always to love the stranger. And you could marry a convert. You can marry a convert.
Right.
But our rabbis saw in the 1930s that there was a danger to the community, the Syrian community. And what was that danger? That there were a few of the young boys who were going out with non-Jews, and they wanted to marry them. And they thought that if this is going to continue, and the community, you have to understand, it was a very small community in the 30s.
Yeah.
I don't even think there was 300 families. Today, maybe there's 35,000 families in the community. And they decided that if they make a decree that if anybody marries a convert, he will not be accepted into the community. He will not have the same privileges of having their children go to our yeshivas. He would not have the privilege of being buried in our cemeteries. And we felt that that was a very strong decree, very strong decree. And the outside Jewish world didn't understand this. But now, when you look back, and now it's 70 years that this decree is in the community, I would venture to say that maybe 1% or 2% of the whole community has intermarried outside of the Jewish faith. So it made our community much stronger, whereas the rest of the Jewish community worldwide is diminishing because of marrying outside of their faith.
But they wouldn't be married outside of their faith if the person converted.
Yes, but you have to understand that you have the Orthodox, yeah. You have the Conservative, and you have the Reform. They today accept it, and still they are losing a lot of Jews to the outside religions. And we, thank God, are strong and getting stronger. You know, it's hard. I mean, there are many times when I say it's not right. not drunk because it's going against the Torah. They're going against the Torah. The Torah says that you should have, you should welcome the convert. You should love them. But you have to weigh the consequences in the society that we're living in and the times that we're living in. Maybe one day they'll eliminate the decree. I guess when the Mashiach comes, he'll tell us if we did right or wrong.
They did this in Brooklyn, in the Brooklyn Syrian community. They did it in,
I think, in Brooklyn and Mexico and in Argentina. Only in the Syrian Jewish community.
Okay. What else do I want to ask you? Do you think there's a big difference? I mean, I know that there's been a Syrian community in Brooklyn, in America, for what, almost 70 years now, right?
I would say 100 years now.
100 years now. Do you think the community has experienced a big change from the beginning till the end? Religiously, and also traditionally.
The Syrian Jews always held to their traditions. They were always synagogue goers. Even the men who in the 20s and 30s had to go and work on Shabbat, still they would love to go to the synagogue. And they made sure that their children all had a Jewish education. They sent them to the Hebrew Talmud Torah. And it's only in the last 20, 25 years where there's been a direction going towards the right, where they're becoming more religious, where the children are becoming more religious. And it's possible it's because, see, when we went to Hebrew, we just had a very rudimentary education. We learned how to read, and we learned how to explain some of the passages in the Bible, and that was about it. Not too many of the boys that were growing up went to an advanced class where they learned Gemara, where they learned Rambam, where they learned. Whereas today, the children are going to yeshiva. They're going to yeshiva from 6 years old all the way till 18 years old. That's 12 years of education and a full curriculum. They're learning everything. So that when they graduate now, they're more interested in the high learning. Many of them want to become religious. Many of them go to Israel to learn, to get more education. They go to yeshiva university or to other yeshivas or to a kollel. And there's no doubt that the community has become much more religious than they were 50, 60 years ago.
But as they become more religious, do you think they keep their traditions just as strongly?
Yes. When you're talking about traditions, what do you mean by traditions?
Meaning, like, the closeness of the families and, holidays and, being with your family. I don't know. I've seen a lot of more religious people in the Syrian community, and it almost seems like they're exactly the same as the very religious from the Ashkenaz community. Do you know what I mean? It almost seems like they're indistinguishable. You can't distinguish between the two. I mean, I don't sit down to have a Pesach, Seder with them, so I don't know. But, I mean, do you think getting more religious is bringing them away from tradition? I mean, what do you think?
You see, the community now is so large. There are many of the boys that are growing up, and because of the Ashkenaz influence in the community, you have to understand that many of our teachers who have gone on to higher learning didn't have the opportunity, or maybe there weren't any of the Sephardic rabbis to teach them, had to go to Ashkenazic yeshivas.
Right.
And they became involved in many of the Ashkenaz traditions, in the way they dress, in the way they talk, in the way they act. Sometimes you can't tell the difference. how do I feel about it? Well, there are many times when I'm not too happy about it. But, listen, over the years, there's always been a change. And there's been a peaks and valleys when it came to Jewish traditions and Jewish adherence to the law. You had many, many periods where the Jews were very intellectual, and then you've had many, many periods where the Jews didn't have anything. But I think it's good for the community.
Getting more religious.
Getting more religious. Even the children who are growing up now, they're going to our own yeshivas. We have our own yeshivas now. In the old days, many of them went to Ashkenazi yeshivas.
Right.
And they never had a high school. Now they have a high school. And they have a kollel now. I envision that the community in 20, 25 years will be like two communities.
Really?
Because many of our youth today who are going to schools that are much more strict, where they do not allow televisions in the home, or where you have to wear a regular, not a yarmulke or a kippah, but a real hat, and they dress like the Ashkenazim, almost. Many of them now are moving outside of Brooklyn. They have a very, very large community in Lakewood. What's going to happen to these children that are growing up over there? They're going to be growing up in the Ashkenazi yeshivas. They're going to lose their identity. And I hope they don't, but many of their laws, many of their customs are being picked up from the Ashkenaz community, which is a powerful, powerful community, the Ashkenaz.
Yeah.
But,
what about in Syria? What do you think it was like there? And what have you heard? Was it very religious?
No, there were many people over there who were not Shomer Shabbat as we see it today. They didn't have cars in those days, so they didn't have to drive on Shabbat.
Right.
They didn't have to put the light on because they left the light on, you know, on Shabbat. But they weren't very, very strict. They were very liberal. And many of our rabbis always looked, especially the Sephardic rabbis, they always looked for the finding a way to do certain things.
Finding a way out, you mean?
Finding a way out. And they would find it within the law. You know? And they were more liberal when it came to religion. Next.
What's that?
That's the last
question. That's all I wanted to know. So you think, I mean, they were very traditional there, though, right? I mean, mothers taught daughters, and daughters,
and
fathers taught sons.
Yes.
And
Oh, yes.
So in that way.
And they lived within the Muslim community over there for 300-400 years, you know, after the expulsion of the Jews from Spain. Many of them went to Syria.
Right.
And there was no problem then, ever, of intermarrying with the outside of the community. Never. They never had that problem. I think it was a different way of living. They lived within their community. You know? And my father tells me that they always got along with the Muslims in the old country. So, I mean, it's a shame that had to end. You know, that now the Jews are out. the only country that really took them in was the Ottoman Empire.
I just think it's so interesting that, I mean, even though this decree doesn't sound very, very good decree, you know, that the Syrian community, it started out with what? You said 200 families, maybe? And now it's 35,000 people, and how it's continued, and the tradition has been passed on successfully, whereas so many other communities, I mean, even Sephardic communities alone,
right.
You don't hear so much about the Greek Sephardic community,
no.
Or the, you know, Italian Sephardic, I mean, I don't even know,
right.
But you don't really hear so much about that. You hear about the Syrian community in Brooklyn, the Syrian community in Dio. It's a very big now and powerful community and strong community, and it built itself up. Why do you think they were so successful and the other communities weren't?
It's a very good question. I really, it's hard to answer a question like that. But I think the biggest reason is that whenever a Syrian would come from Syria to America, he never looked to go anyplace else except to Brooklyn. He wanted to be with his own people. He felt very, very comfortable. We are very, very clannish. We like to be with our own people. If we go on vacation, we want to be with our own people. If we go to Deal, we want to be, if we went to Bradley Beach, we were all together over there. If we go to Florida, we all want to be together in Florida. I mean, it's not the best. It's better to be involved with other people, you know? And I think there's much animosity from the Ashkenaz community because we are like that, and they feel that we are aloof, and we think that we're superior from our actions, you know, which we don't have that feeling of being superior, you know. But it's a good question. I really can't answer it. Why we want to live together, I don't know.
I think that it ensured that you would become such a strong community and such a big community because you stuck together, because you stayed together and worked together and set up a community and set up, you know? I think that was crucial.
Yeah, there were many people who left the community over the years, the last 60, 70 years, that went to California, that went to Texas, that went to Florida, that went to Troy, New York, to Chicago. Many Jews left. They went for different reasons. Maybe it's because they couldn't get along in the community. Maybe they couldn't, because it's very hard to live in this community if you aren't making money. People who are very sensitive, you know, who felt that if they didn't have money, they don't want to live with the Syrians because they don't want to be seen as below them. You know, so they would leave, and they would go to other places, open up businesses, become successful. 90% of the children have been married. Very few of them are married to the Jews. When I look at the family that my father was with, the Gerazi family, they moved to Denver, Colorado. Very, very difficult to live out of New York.